Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. He's early, 30 seconds early. Hey everybody, it's Kai. It is Make Me Smart. That's the podcast you have tuned into or clicked play on or however it is you listen to us. None of us, as we like to say, mostly on Tuesdays around here, is as smart as all of us, is the tagline.
That's right. And the mission. It's Tuesday, right. Which means it is time to get smart on a single topic with a deep dive and an expert. Today, that topic, and we've been talking about this a long time, I'm excited, is labor unions.
Union membership and organized labor at large in this economy has been on something of a slide. So here are some numbers. In 1970, almost a third of the American workforce was a member of organized labor. In 2020, that number was basically 10% or so. But, and the reason we're doing this podcast today is that labor unions do seem to be having a moment.
Definitely. Specifically in the South right now, there's a unionization effort. This is why we haven't done this episode in so long, because it's hard to say unionization, turns out. But there is an effort to unionize at an Amazon warehouse. In Silicon Valley, tech workers are forming, either joining unions or forming sort of slightly different types of unions. They're interested in the labor movement. And of course, all of this is colliding with this kind of question of gig work and flexibility and independent contractors. So it seemed like a good time to have this talk.
Yeah. And let me throw another variable in there, right? Which is capitalism as we come out of this pandemic and whatever the heck that's going to look like, because it is definitely going to be different. Anyway, so the expert at hand is Lane Wyndham. She's the associate director at the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. Also, by the way, the author of a book called Knocking on Labor's Doors, Union Organizing in the 1970s and Roots of a New Economic Divide. Lane, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Kai and Molly, I'm thrilled to be here with you.
So maybe we could start with a basic of what organized labor and union membership means today, because I think for a lot of people, it's a person working at like an auto plant in Detroit someplace, and it's different now.
That's exactly right. A lot of times when we think of union members, we think of, you know, a white guy in a hard hat, right? But union membership today is far more reflective of the workforce. It's far more diverse. Lots of women, lots of people of color. In fact, if you look at union membership overall, 2/3 of union members are women and or people of color, right? And in fact, women were on track to be the majority of union membership by 2030 until we hit the pandemic and women's employment changed dramatically. And we actually haven't seen the numbers yet on the projections for women's union membership. But women were on track to be a majority of union members.
Tell us about why there's this kind of renewed interest in your view. We're seeing tech workers, obviously university professors, full disclosure, journalists here at Marketplace, I'm sure you've seen the tweets, becoming interested in unionizing. What do you think is driving this sort of renewed push?
Yeah, and there's definitely a new level of interest in unions among professionals, especially young professionals. So graduate employees, adjunct professors, like you were saying, workers in the digital media platforms, Gawker, Vice, BuzzFeed, The Onion, right? Gimlet just got their first contract after unionizing last year. That's a podcast company. And of course, reporters and traditional outlets have had unions for a long time. But I think what we're seeing is that it's in part this renewed interest in unions and is a response to changes in the professions, or as Kai said, changes in capitalism, right? Those digital media jobs are precarious. And as you know, that industry is constantly changing. Let's look at professors. You used to have full-time tenured professors. That was a really secure job. But now 3/4 of professors are not on tenure track at all. Those are the adjunct jobs are low-paid, precarious jobs. So as working conditions have degraded and become less secure, people are organizing. You know, and they're doing that because they want more security in an economy where their security is just harder to come by. And a union contract makes a real difference. You know, people who have a union and on average make 22% more than those who don't. They're far more likely to have employer-provided health care and pensions. People with union contract, about 94% of them have employer-provided health care compared to 68% of people who don't have a union. But here's the thing, is that unions are more than just what's in your paycheck, right? They also mean that workers have a voice on the job. And when you think about it, America's workplaces are pretty much the least democratic spaces that we have in this country. People think they have far more rights on the job than they actually do. Unless you have a union contract, your employer can legally fire you, not for discrimination, right? But they can legally fire you and you don't have a right to free speech on the job. And so unions basically bring that democracy with a small d back into the workplace.
Do you think, though, that the shift in unionization that we talked about a minute ago from traditional hard hat blue collar workers to knowledge workers in this economy, is this a pivot point? Is it a turning point, do you think, or a returning point, I suppose, for organized labor in this economy?
Right. How big is it?
Well, first let me Yeah. So first I would say, I think this is an and story, and it's not an either or story. And what I mean by that is, even though we do see that there are white collar workers organizing, you have continued interest among blue collar workers. And I actually, in preparation for chatting with you, I pulled the entire list of labor board elections from last year, which includes stuff before the pandemic, because I wanted just to check. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of organizing. Like we said, there's lots in media, but there's also lots happening in manufacturing and hospitals and casinos and delivery companies and slaughterhouses and recycling and waste management. And those are not as flashy as Gawker or Vice, or I guess The Onion, right? But they are, you know, it's very important, just as we learned during this pandemic, that essential workers provide services that keep our entire society running, right? And they are often unseen. It is very important that we continue to see the organizing efforts, the collective action among all workers, white collar and blue collar workers, because, you know, when those hospital workers, those healthcare workers say, hey, I need a voice on the job, we need to listen. And that needs to be important, too.
Yeah, it does feel, as you're describing it, like a somewhat inevitable pendulum, right? You know, union membership declines, worker protections decline. Suddenly we have armies and armies of contract workers and stagnant wages and increasingly poor working conditions. And it doesn't seem that surprising that people would look to a remedy. I wonder, how does this pendulum swing back toward unions without maybe repeating past mistakes?
Well, this is an excellent question, because the issue is not that people don't want unions. And people have actually wanted unions for quite some time. However, in this country, in order to enter a union and to have a collective bargaining agreement, there are so many hurdles that workers have to get through, basically. You know, we have a system where workers have to trigger sign union cards, then trigger a union board election, then go through this 12-week election period when the employer has free access to force people into mandatory attendance meetings where, you know, they can talk endlessly against the union and the union's not allowed in the room. And if an employer breaks the law, there is no penalty, none. If they are found guilty, all the employer has to do is hang a blue and white sign in the break room that says, oops, broke the law, right? And so why wouldn't employers break labor law, you know? And in fact, that's what, starting in the 1970s, that's what union busters began to teach management. They trained them in basically how to bend and break the law at new levels. And so if we are going to have a situation where working people have access to unions, where they are a larger number are able to enter into a collective bargaining agreement, we are going to have to strengthen the law. We're going to have to shore up the law basically do what President Biden suggested in his recent video message on unions, which is that employers need to not be able to weigh in on the process of workers forming unions. And that would be an enormous change.
All right. Well, look, I will take second place to nobody in being skeptical of the congressional ability to do anything in its current incarnation, except on a straight party line vote, which, you know, as things are currently distributed in Congress, tilts the Democrats' way. But let's talk about the president and the PRO Act, which was just introduced in the House. There are moves afoot, but I wonder how serious you think any of these union protections might turn out to be, Joe Biden being the most pro-union president ever, notwithstanding.
Right. So, as you know, the House recently passed what's called the PRO Act, or the Protecting the Right to Organize Act. And now it faces going to the Senate and a probable filibuster in the Senate. The labor law reform has faced this exact same situation in 1978, in 2007, in 2008. It gets through the House and it can't make it through the Senate, you know. Right. And, you know, the PRO Act does have some elements that certainly would shore up workers' freedom to form unions. Like, it, for instance, employers couldn't pull workers into these, you know, one-sided mandatory meetings against the unions. There would be actual penalties if they broke the law. So there, it's good legislation. But yes, the battle is getting it through the Senate. History shows that, you know, that workers have not been able to benefit from legislation in front of the Senate for decades.
Right. Insert our constant ongoing recommendation to read the book. Thank you to Kai for introducing me to the book Kill Switch, so that we can just constantly tell you over and over about the filibuster history detailed in that book. It's amazing. Tell us about, though, you know, absent federal legislation, which is clearly TBD at best. You say that what's happening in Alphabet, Google's parent company, and this sort of different kind of unionizing could be revolutionary to the labor movement. How so, and how might it sort of move forward, you know, in the interim?
Right. So, yes, I'm fascinated by what the Alphabet Workers Union is doing. They basically are saying, you know what? Rather than having a system that and following labor law, which is all about jumping over all these hurdles that workers have to get through, and a small number of people finally make it over that and we'll have a collective bargaining agreement. They're just saying, everybody in. If you want to have a union here, be part of it, come on in. And we're going to start acting and behaving and standing up like a union, whether we've won their election or not, right? We are going to, basically, it's called a minority union. And they are beginning to build power and sort of going around the broken labor law system. And it's very exciting. It's very interesting. And I am definitely keeping an eye on what they're able to do.
What do you make of the Amazon movement down in Alabama, right?
Well, a lot of people were surprised that the first big election at an Amazon warehouse was in the South, right? Alabama. The New York Times, in fact, called it unlikely. But my research shows that it's very likely, in fact. The warehouse workforce is majority female and upwards of 80% people of color, which research shows are the groups that are most likely to support unionization. And that's long been true. The book, Knocking on Labor's Door, that I wrote is about how after the 1964 Civil Rights Act, when women and people of color gained new access to the kinds of jobs from which they'd long been excluded, they began to unionize those jobs, and they powered a whole wave of union organizing in the 1970s, much in the South. But employers ramped up their resistance to unions and began to bend and break labor law at a whole new level. And so they basically prevented those workers from entering into the collective bargaining relationship. But women and people of color, including in the South, have a very long history of organizing in this country. So I'm not as surprised as the New York Times is.
I'm just biting off a lot of comments about the New York Times. What about the last thing I want to ask you is, you know, California passed a law that was not union specific, but in, you know, an attempt to make employers employ the people who work for them. There are concerns that the PRO Act, while it would strengthen unions, would potentially cut off avenues for freelancers, for people who sincerely and truly want to be independent contractors and freelancers. And there's been this conversation in California about the third way, to acknowledge that work has changed and maybe there are other ways than a very traditional 8-to-5 sort of prescribed job title situation. I wonder what you think about that.
Right. What the PRO Act does is it basically prevents an employer from calling someone an independent contractor just so they can get around labor law and basically prevent them from forming a union. Freelancers would not be forced into any kind of a union. Basically, they would have to, under the PRO Act, freelancers would have to proactively say, hey, we want a union, and they would have to join together with other freelancers for a common employer and act collectively and try to form a union, right? I think that what we saw in California, which goes beyond the law that governs unionization, it also deals with, you know, all the various wage and hour issues that impact workers, unemployment, you know, wages, et cetera, et cetera. What we are seeing there is that the future of capitalism and the future of work right now is being written. And to me, one of the most important questions that we have to ask is who are those rules going to be written for? To whose benefit, right? And who is going to have power within the future of capitalism? And I believe that coming off of the pandemic, we're having a different conversation about that because people have seen the essential workers. They've seen the way that working people are often devalued and the way that racial and gender inequities are baked into that system. And so I think we're ready to have a new conversation about the future of capitalism. And we're not done. I do not think that vote in California means that we're done. I think that was just the beginning of that conversation.
Dr. Lane Wyndham, Associate Director at the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University, and her book is called Knocking on Labor's Door. Thank you so much.
I was thrilled to talk with you.
Thanks a lot, Lane. Appreciate it.
Thank you. What a wonderful, fascinating, open-ended ending.
Who's gonna write the path dependencies.
Yeah. Who's going to write the rules? And you have to think that so much of this is going to be influenced. We're still living in the pandemic moment that is changing labor so much. But you have to think that a lot of those rules are going to be crafted in response to the year that we all just had. And it's really interesting. This is the rare moment where I sort of feel like we did not detail a huge bummer problem that we don't have an answer for. We actually have like, we're on the road and there's a wide open road ahead.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
Fun.
A rare glimmer
what
of hope.
What a fun change.
All right. We're gonna ride that hope into a break. Send us your comments on today's show or, you know, anything you hear on this podcast ever. You can do it by sending us an email if you must or a voice memo. That'd be better to makemesmartatmarketplace.org. Coming right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
And we're back. It is time for the news fix. I would have picked Kai's, so let's start there.
Because let's start here. So it's a piece in Politico this morning about Google and antitrust investigations and how the FTC's lawyers and economists in 2011 said to their political bosses, yes, we have to do something about Google and the way it's taking over mobile advertising and data. And the political bosses said, no, we're good. We're good. It's all right.
Right.
Let's just let it ride.
Right.
And here we are a decade later, and the Justice Department and Federal Trade Commission and all of those are sort of in the same place fighting that same battle now with these big tech companies. And the reason I thought of it was because of the moves that the Biden administration is making conceivably in this direction, right? They're putting Tim Wu into the National Economic Council. He's been a guest on this podcast, and we've talked to him about big tech. What's her name? Lina Khan, right? From Columbia, maybe going to the Federal Trade Commission. There is change afoot, but they were doing it 10 years ago, and the politician said, no, we're good.
And the economists, the FTC's economists said no, which is what's so interesting. I mean, this is like, I encourage you, especially if you are even remotely a policy or an antitrust wonk, to read this entire story. It is a blockbuster. It should profoundly shake up Washington, because what it shows is that in some ways, some of the FTC lawyers thought they had the goods. These economists made a series of predictions that either defied logic, like saying that Google didn't have a monopoly on ads, even though they had found it had 65% market share, or made predictions that turned out to just be like profoundly mistaken, even in the face of evidence that they were going to be mistaken. For example, they said like mobile phones aren't going to be a big deal, so that's not a big market. Mm-hmm. And this was like in 2010, 2011, when, you know, every analyst was like, you can plot this chart. And on top of that, it's all of these documents were sort of obtained by accident because they're not available to FOIA. Right. And on top of that, a bunch of these economists and then FTC commissioners have gone on to work at Google.
Yeah.
So like on the one hand, you could make a real, you know, you could sort of say like things were up in the air. We didn't know. It seemed like Google was going to be a big deal, but nobody could predict how big. On the other hand, this is a swing and a miss that then leads directly to a revolving door that should be studied for a while. It's a big deal story.
Yeah. It's a good one. I'm glad I beat you to it.
I know,
me too. I saw it early this morning. I was like, oh, I'm taking that one, putting it in there before Molly gets it.
It's perfect. that's how we roll, audience. It's just an ongoing battle for news fix supremacy.
I got it first. Oh, sorry.
Now you can still talk about it as much as you would have otherwise, though. I don't know. So there.
Yes.
Well, I actually have a related story, which I think is I have been fascinated to watch China's crackdown on big tech, which is inspired from a very different place, but is going to end up looking kind of similar. So you have President Xi Jinping saying, you know, regulators need to step up their oversight of these big internet companies. You know how I feel about China's parallel tech economy, which is just endlessly fascinating to me. Wants a crackdown on monopolies, promotion of fair competition, prevention of the disorderly expansion of capital. And this is all according to Chinese state TV. And what is so interesting about this is that it seems to be an antitrust campaign that's much more similar to like the Brandeis age when who was the Rough Rider guy?
Theodore Roosevelt.
This is so embarrassing. Theodore Roosevelt was essentially convinced by Louis Brandeis, then of the eventual Supreme Court justice, that these big companies were a threat to the government. And that's why they needed to be regulated. And that appears to be the motivation behind China's crackdown. Like, they got really concerned that Ant, the big fintech company, was going to disrupt the financial institutions there. And then, of course, Jack Ma, the former CEO of Alibaba, went away. Yeah. Disappeared for a while and then came back and was like, I'm totally in line with the but it, as usual, it's this kind of like parallel happening that might end up having a similar result.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just think it is really, really interesting.
Yeah.
To watch.
There we
That's
go.
That's all. That's all
there
I
we
got.
Go. All right. Yep. Those are two good items. I like those.
I know. Look at that. Yeah. And they're so related.
Yeah.
Ta-da! And that's it. Easy peasy news fix. Let's hear from you in the mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Long-time listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
I'm feeling embarrassed about my pandemic brain. Who's that Rough Rider president?
No, it's all good.
You know that guy? He's got a national park out in North Dakota. Anyway, we have a voice memo. Yay! It comes from Josh in Virginia, and it comes with a photo.
Cool.
The picture that I have attached sits on the desk in my classroom here in Arlington, Virginia. It is like a little time capsule for me. It was our last day of full in-person instruction, and we thought we were just going home for a few weeks. Hmm. Now I keep it on my desk facing me to remind myself that as I get comfortable in the situation, I need to still remember that we all have to stay safe and do all of the mitigations so that we get to the end. We are so close to the end, yet so far away. I know Make Me Smart and the rest of the world uses the 11th as the beginning in the United States, but for me, it will be March 13th. Thank you guys for everything you have done in the past year. And probably one of the most important things that you've done for me is you've kept it so that I know what day of the week it is.
That's us, public service journalism. That's what we do. That's what we do.
If nothing else, by God, we put the date on every podcast.
Oh, good God.
And he sent us a photo, and it's one. And this is actually amazing because it is in itself a time machine.
Yeah.
He's got one of those paper tear-off daily calendars, but it's still there on Friday the 13th, Friday, March 13th, 2020.
I should tell you,
it's a Jeopardy one.
Yeah, my kids actually go with Friday, March 13th because that's when they had their last day of in-person school. So
yeah. Which I think is reasonable. Ours, I think it was the same thing. They went to. I actually kept my son home that Thursday and Friday, and then nobody went back on the Monday.
Yeah,
because I was like, I've had it.
And now the weird part is, just we've talked about social anxiety and getting back to normal a couple of times. There's my local school district has a reopening plan, and there's chatter among the kids in town. They're like, I don't know if it's going to be weird to go back, and all those people, you know, and you're like, wow.
Yeah. Well, and it's weird for kids, too. Yeah. I realized how I would feel as a child because they can't get the vaccine.
Yep.
And so for teenagers who are acutely aware of this fact and yet being sent back to school, I'm sure it feels a little uncaring on the behalf of these adults who are like, you'll probably be fine.
Yeah. I got my shot. You'll be all right.
Right.
Sorry.
Right?
Yeah. Like, no, totally.
I'm exactly increasingly having a hard time looking my 14-year-old in the eye and being like, no, you'll be fine. He's like, math is math, Mom.
Oh, man.
It's weird.
We talked last week about what to call this period when we seem to be approaching the beginning of the end of maybe not having to do this anymore. Possibly, we don't know. There was a suggestion that day that the denouement was what we might call it. Some of you had other ideas. Here's Anne in San Francisco.
The denouement is a pretty good suggestion, but it reminds me of what my dad, a former naval officer and growing up a Navy brat, used to call channel fever. Of when you can see land, when you're kind of in the channel, but you know there are hours before you're actually going to be able to dock. I think about that phrase a lot, and it feels very relevant for this time. Thanks so much for the great show. I love listening.
The thing about that is she's totally right, because what happens is when you're riding the boat in from deployment and you can see the beach, it is still hours. And you're like, how can it possibly be taking this long to go however many miles it is? And you're like, come on, man, get me out of here. That's exactly right. And that's the metaphor for this period of time, right? Because we can see the end, but it's going to be a long while, relatively speaking, before we get there.
I think that is so perfect. I've been telling my friends that it's like when you have to go to the bathroom and then the closer you get to home, the more you have to pee. And then you're standing on the front door and you can never find your keys. And you're like, that's it. I'm just going to pee on the doorstep. Like, I can't make it in the side.
Oh, my God.
But it turns out channel fever is much more appropriate and also awesome. Let's just use that. Kai's a Navy guy.
Man.
Yeah, I love it. Let's start calling it that.
We'll skip the peeing on the porch analogy. We'll just call it channel fever. Oh, my Lord. Okay.
Last week, we talked about shipping containers stuck at ports because of the surge in global shipping orders. I did not know it was a traffic jam. It was amazing. And we talked about a shortage of longshoremen because of COVID concerns. John from San Pedro, California, works at one of these ports. I love this kind of voicemail. He wanted to share a few more details with us.
The bigger problem that we're having is getting the cans off the terminal and out to their final destinations. There's not enough truck drivers to pick up the cans. And the railroads are having a hard time providing cars for the cans to go into so they can be shipped across the country. Additionally, the warehouses are currently full, and the shippers are having a problem getting a hold of empty containers to ship back to China to fill with more stuff.
That's amazing.
That is great. First of all, so I guess cans is containers, right? And also, we were talking only about the ports, but it's a problem up and down that supply chain, right? You don't have rail cars with enough room for the containers. You don't have truck drivers. That's cray-cray. Man.
Yeah, that's a whole different level of supply chain problem. You should totally do that on your show. That's a good series of stories. Mm-hmm. Thank you to our intrepid producers always on the job. Kids age 16 and up can get, I believe, the Pfizer vaccine. So some teenagers are able to get vaccinated. Yeah. Alaska actually just went wide open, which I personally think is the right strategy at this point, and said everybody 16 and up can get vaccinated, and I know one 17-year-old. But for the 14-year-old who's looking me dead in the eye.
No chance, pal.
Not yet.
Yeah.
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 So thanks. Thanks, producers.
Okay, so with that, the Make Me Smart question, of course, what is something you thought you knew you later found out you were wrong about? Jennifer in Arizona is up next.
I thought once I had enough money saved for a down payment that buying my first home would be fun and easy. Boy, was I wrong.
Oh, Jennifer.
No one mentions the bidding war mortgage companies will get into over your business. What the heck points are? Appraisals, inspection after inspection. I have been blown away at the hundreds of pages of legalese I've had to sort through in the past few weeks. I graduated college in the early 2000s, right into the mortgage crisis and resulting recession. I've been resistant to buying my first home because of all the damage I saw back then. But my lease is almost up and the rates are crazy low now, so I finally gave in. But man, this is not the process I thought it would be. All that said, I'm looking forward to 1 month from today when, as long as nothing else crazy pops up, at nearly 40 years old, I'll be getting the keys to my very first home.
I'd like to hear from the other brand new homeowner on this podcast. There we go, right?
I got the keys to my first home at 45. Yeah. It's true. I mean, I briefly owned a home when I was married. But yes, in my 45 years of life until now, I had been a homeowner for all of 2 years. And Jennifer, I am with you. DM me. It's okay. It's going to happen. And we should do, this reminds me actually of there's a really interesting story brewing about this company that's trying to just like upend, and this one guy who's trying to upend the entire real estate system, because it is quite clear. Yeah, the particularly the realtor commissions.
Oh, well, yeah.
Which he's, you know, he's like, that's totally prohibitive. It's like in a in a crazy market that is already, you know, $30,000 or something for people is absurd, and means that the down payment hurdle is even so much higher. But also it does seem kind of clear that like maybe it doesn't really need to be quite this hard.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It doesn't have to be this hard. That's exactly right.
I don't think it does. And it has so far been sort of disruption proof, and I would say not for long. But more importantly, Jennifer, congratulations to you. Congratulations to us. It's really
it's good stuff.
It's hard work. It's hard work. I saved for 10 years, by God. We did it.
And there you are.
Yep.
All right.
All right. Don't forget to send us your answer. As you can see, every topic is welcome. We love it. Which again is, what is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? Voice memos, please, to makemesmart@marketplace.org.
All right, we're done. That's it. Tomorrow's What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. Still taking questions, of course. If you don't want to get yelled at or, you know, perhaps, you know, scorned, I don't know. Voice memos, that's the way to go. We'll see you tomorrow. I'm just saying. I'm just saying. Voice memos.
I know.
Are
I
better.
Just know we're leaving people out with this one. So, robot voice, welcome. If necessary, do it.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner produces stuff for us. Also, by the way, he's going to put those instructions for that voice memo on the show page. I had somebody yell at me on Twitter about that the other day, and I'm like, I'll get Tony to fix it. Erica Phillips does our newsletters, also our smart speaker skills.
You should throw in one of those YouTube videos on how to do something with a robot voice. If it's good enough for TikTok, it's good enough for us. Today's program was engineered by Garrett Lang with mixing by Liana Squillace. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music, Grammy. The senior producer is Donna Tam. And the executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves.
Bang Zoom.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.